This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on February 11th. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. Just a reminder that Co-op's spring membership drive is coming soon. It's not too early to go to koop.org and click the donate button at the top of the homepage. Thanks. 2 weeks ago in the New York Times, Jamel Bowie wrote an opinion piece titled "The Backlash Against CRT Shows That Republicans Are Losing Ground." He notes that lawmakers are applying a lot of scrutiny to elementary, secondary, and college curriculums, looking for indoctrination under the all-encompassing term critical race theory. Bowie observes that, coincidentally, about the same time that Republicans were drafting anti-CRT legislation, a new edition of W.E.B. Du Bois' 1935 classic, Black Reconstruction in America, was released. In it, Du Bois is disconcerted that historical evils must be, quote, forgotten, distorted, and skimmed over, unquote. He wrote, "We must forget that George Washington was a slave owner, or that Thomas Jefferson had mixed-race children, and simply remember the things we regard as creditable and inspiring. The problem is that history loses its value and incentive and example. It paints perfect men and noble nations, but it does not tell the truth." Bowie points out the obvious connection with present circumstances. While he is not so simplistic to declare that this movement to censor American history is doomed to failure, he does believe that the urgency of their efforts is significant. Bowie concludes that, quote, "the ferocity of the drive to keep serious discussions of race and racism out of American classrooms is an admission, however tacit, that something has changed, and conservatives are on the losing end of that transformation. Where once they were an establishment, such that Du Bois was a voice in the wilderness, now they are on the defensive," unquote. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is no stranger to this show. Charlotte Moore joins us once again. Charlotte is a storyteller with over 20 years of experience as a print and television news journalist, multimedia producer, filmmaker, and writer. Her film, Black Bodies, is a documentary in which 16 Black Austin area residents talk candidly and vulnerably about what it means to exist in the world today in a Black body. Her most recent film, The Spirit of Sparta, tells the story of Sparta, Georgia, once deemed the hidden jewel of Georgia, but which today faces daunting challenges. Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, is also with us. Charlotte, it's so good to have you here. How have you been?
Oh, Bob and Michelle, it's so good to be back. Yeah, it's just so good to be back and hear your voice. I've been good. I've been good here in Atlanta. How about you all? How's it been here in Austin?
Well, like everywhere, the pandemic continues. We do this show through Zoom, and I got to say that's taking a little bit of a toll on me, but I really miss the studio. I miss being with our guests
in person and the feel of all that that we miss in this mediated environment that we're in. But we get by, and I think we've survived. Michelle, how's it been for you?
Yeah, I concur. Things here in Austin are much like they are, you know, across the country. We all just continue to deal with coping with the pandemic. And it's been nice to have Civil Rights and Wrongs as an outlet to, you know, get to know more people, certainly in a COVID-safe way, I guess, and hear their stories. So
sure.
I always enjoy hearing from Charlotte.
And Charlotte, you know, when we last spoke with you, it was still the Black Bodies Project, but now I note that you've changed the name, or it's evolved to the Anti-Racism Art House. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say, yeah, it's amazing. The last time we were all together, the world and certainly the country in Austin was very, very different. Things have just evolved. So yeah, the Black Bodies Project came out of just really beautifully morphed out from that film I did. The film Black Bodies, I did it because I felt led to produce this film, and I had a great educational time doing it. And that film opened up for me so many doors of opportunity and people I met. You know, it played at film festivals, and we had umpteen screenings. This was before the pandemic. We had several screenings with amazing audiences. And then after COVID hit, it was, I hate to say it, but it was even better. I hate to use that word in context with a pandemic, but for the purpose of screening a film, it allowed us to do that online so we could reach more people. And so out of that film came the Black Bodies Project, because I really thought it would just be a project where I did these sort of offshoot things from it, an interview series, and then we did our book. But then a good friend of mine, Caroline Alexander, my partner in this nonprofit, said, you know, you should start an organization and do more of this. And so we did. We called it the Black Bodies Project. But then my daughter, who is a millennial and she is forever on Twitter, sat me down one day and she said, Mom, you know, I love you. You know, I love you. You know, I love that film, Black Bodies. I'm proud of you. But on Twitter, there's a conversation about the term Black Bodies. And I listened, and she proceeded to tell me that that term had become a little offensive to people. It's a term that's been used a lot, and it sort of relegates Black people to their bodies. And we talked for a good long time about it, and I completely got that and thought anyway that for a nonprofit name, it probably didn't work as a project. And to wrap this up, I love art. I've always been an artist from the time I was a little girl, drawing pictures and writing. And so for me, I think art is a universal healer, a universal salve for the things that ail us as a human race. And then the word anti-racism, that term has gained a lot of momentum. And I think Anti-Racism Art House explains exactly who we are and what we want to do, which is use art to help end racism.
Got it. And I'll point out that this is your secondary job, right? You're also fully employed, I think, at CNN, right?
Yeah, I'm a writer with CNN International, which is a different channel from CNN. It's all under CNN, though, but CNN International, I kind of think we're a little bit better than, you know, regular old CNN, because we cover the world, you know. It's like, we're not just America people, this is a world. And so, yeah, I've been here 2 years in Atlanta. I go back and forth to Austin, and then my partner with the nonprofit is still in Austin, and nothing is ever set in stone. So right. Austin's where I'm from, and we'll see what happens in the future.
Sure. Well, no commitments here today. I would like to hear about your latest film, if we could lead off with that, The Spirit of Sparta. Tell us about it. This is a town in Georgia, right?
It is. Wherever I am, I have to tell stories. I have to. So being here in Atlanta, I've been looking for ways to exercise my storytelling muscle outside of work. and I have to stay focused on this issue of racism in Black people. So out of the blue, a woman who lives here in Atlanta reached out to me. Basically, she wrote me a message on Messenger and said, "Charlotte, have you ever heard of Sparta, Georgia?" And I responded, "No." And she proceeded to explain to me, we ended up talking on the phone. She began to explain to me the specifics about this small town about an hour's drive east of Atlanta that is about 90% Black. I mean, that's pretty much all Black people in this small town. And her passion and the way she talked, I knew that this was a story that I wanted to pursue. She described a town that was so rich in Black history, but in the middle of town is this really big Confederate monument that is very well kept. But around that monument, right down Main Street, it's just completely run down. About 35% of the people who live there live below the poverty line. A lot of dilapidated buildings, a lot of really horrible looking old houses that aren't being kept up. And a couple of people in the film that I talked to said it looks like a ghost town, but it's so full of rich African-American history, the city and the county that it's in. And so I went with her. We went there and back about 3 or 4 times, had my camera, talked to some locals, and we ended up with this short film that really is by, for, and about Tamika McClendon, who is the woman who approached me. It's sort of her ode to her ancestors, the people who helped build this small town and what they're going through.
Yeah, I watched it. You put in some beautiful cinematography. I really loved at the very end all the different faces that you focused on, because it just kind of made the whole small town just come into focus, so to speak, through the faces of all these people. I will also comment that for me, it kind of brought up in my mind some parallels to Tulsa and the Greenwood District, and the history there kind of parallels. Obviously, there was no massacre there like there was in Tulsa, but it sounds to me like kind of the same parallels of the vivacity of the community basically being completely obliterated over time.
First of all, thank you for all of that. My background is in writing. I feel like a pretty solid writer. I love to write. It's only been recently that I had the courage to really take a camera, and my beautiful friend Ann Bannister taught me. She showed me how to operate the camera, and then how to edit, how to get on Adobe, you know, Premiere Pro, and put these stories together. And so I am doing the best I can. And the hope is that someday I can have like a squad of people who work with me, who are real cinematographers and real editors. Not that I'm not, but thank you for saying that, because I look at my films and I think, God, you know, I want to do this better. But also thank you for seeing that parallel, because that's the kind of thing I recognized too. And I didn't until after I was done editing it with what happened in Tulsa. But then also when we talk about voting rights and what's happening right now across the country, that the Black vote is being watered down intentionally. We know it. We see it. That parallel is there too. And, you know, of course, the Confederate monuments. It's happening all across the country. Small rural towns are experiencing the same things that these big cities are. It's just that so many of them have much less support and they're not heard. And so thank you for saying that.
You know, you pointed out the tremendous poverty there, and the needs come across loud and clear. What I heard was, first and foremost, medical facilities seem to be terribly lacking. But just the whole economic scene there, you know, so much of the downtown area almost looks bombed out. You know, it's a lot of empty storefronts, but at the same time, a lot of potential and a lot of hope that someday the glory days of Sparta may return.
Right. And this is from the people, because, you know, I didn't know anything about this town. You're right. The hospital there was closed down, and the nearest hospital is about, I think they say, 20 miles away. And the leaders say that's okay. And if something were to happen and someone needed to go, you know, to the hospital, they could send a helicopter or something. But a lot of the people who live there are older, and we just got through COVID. And so the people are saying, we need a hospital, we need a hospital. But what they keep hearing is, there's a hospital 20 minutes away or wherever, yeah. But that's not enough.
You also got in a little bit into the history. I don't know how much of that you want to get into here, but kind of a tragedy in some ways. The figure of John McCown looms large in that. Say more about that, if you would.
One of the things that really bugs me as a Black woman is that every February or, you know, whenever we talk about Black history, it's, you know, Harriet Tubman, it's Frederick Douglass, to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, who are phenomenal, phenomenal people. They should always be on our minds. But my God, there are so many Black people in American history that we just don't know about. I had never heard of John McCown. I got here, went to Sparta, and many of the Black people there that I spoke with mentioned him. This man was a huge civil rights figure back in the 60s and the 70s. And, you know, if you go online and Google, there's not a whole lot about him. And I ended up having to buy a book called Black Boss, written by a man named John Rozier. It's called Black Boss, Political Revolution in a Georgia County. And John McCown, who again, he did a lot of civil rights action in the 60s and 70s in the South. He was from North Carolina, I believe, had a very storied life, ended up in Hancock County where Sparta is, and actually got people, the Black people there, to vote. Many of them were intimidated by voting. There was a lot of voter suppression. Hancock County is credited as the first county in the U.S. after Reconstruction that was run by majority Black people. Think about that. Like, that's a piece of American history that we should probably all know, and we don't. But this book, I need to say, paints John McCown in a rather unflattering light. You know, it describes him as someone who may have been exploiting a lot of what was going on in this county. He was able to get grants from the government. There were reports of he and other people at the time misusing funds, and there were indictments, and just a lot of stuff happened. But the people, some of the people there will tell you that may or may not be what actually happened, but whatever happened, he was able to inspire a movement where Black people, a majority Black town, I mean, they took ownership of their existence. So yeah, you know, John McCown, people should look him up. They should know who he is.
And who knows what sort of inspection or intense gaze he may have been under for being a successful Black person, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. We know what happens. Like, we don't have to even, if you need examples, Google some stuff, because there are plenty of examples of Black people gaining power. And then very soon after, things begin to happen. I didn't know John McCown, and I can't speak, you know, with any authority on what he may or may not have done. But I do know American history. And just based on what I know,
yeah.
For me, the fact that he was able to rally the vote and get Black people voting and to have this county be run by Black leaders, that to me is pretty amazing.
Yeah, those are the two things that struck out for me also watching your film, is learning about John McCown and the history of that county in Georgia in the Reconstruction narrative, basically. Thank you for that as well. Every time I hear little snippets of stories like you tell in this film, people that we talk to here on Civil Rights and Wrongs, books that I've been reading lately, and I learn more and more of the history of the unknowns in the Black community, it certainly paints a much different picture than what I've been brought up to learn.
Same with me. We went to the same schools, Michelle. You know, we read from the same books. And to be a Black person, sometimes I feel guilt or shame. Shame is probably a better word for not knowing more. But then I tell myself, how would I know? If I didn't learn it, if it wasn't taught, how would I know? So thankfully, when you're older, you can look some of this stuff up.
I'm still tutoring part-time at Navarro High School here, what used to be Lanier High School. I'm working with a regular teacher there, and she's got all the kids doing posters on Black leaders. Each kid has chosen a different Black leader in history, and it's kind of funny, you know, talking about what we learned in school and where we are in history. The teacher had given them a list of names or suggestions, and, you know, a couple of them picked out musicians. One of them had Marvin Gaye. I told the kid, you know, he was a singer. He was a great singer. And we pulled up some of his songs. And of course, the kid had not heard any of those. You know? And I was saying, you know, when I was in high school, when I was your age, this was playing on the radio all the time. You know?
Yeah, anyway. That is some of the best music.
Oh. Right. Oh, yeah. Wonderful stuff. Mercy, Mercy Me, for example. I mean, what a great song that was. And so many songs about the war and about the environment and just an awareness, a societal awareness that was really blossoming at that time and that we're realizing now, you know, we can point to. Of course, when I was on the west side of Cleveland, a very white area, and just hearing Motown music on the radio, you know, I liked the beat and everything, but I had no idea. You know, I just look back on my own existence, and, you know, it's taken me this long to come to a social awareness that I'm at today.
Yeah. And kudos to that kid who chose Marvin Gaye, because, you know, that music too, Marvin Gaye had such a beautiful, mellow voice. And a lot of his songs were about love. Right. And America has made it really, really, really difficult for young Black people, or anybody really, any young person, to equate Black men and Black women with love, like just pure, innocent. I mean, you know, his songs were pretty sexy, but I mean, right. but pure love, you know? And so, yeah, that's great that they are listening to some of his music and listening to that mellow voice.
Right. Well, what are your plans for the film? Where does it go from here?
Well, I have entered it in a couple of film festivals, one here in Atlanta. And so I'm hoping that a film festival will pick it up. We actually have a screening coming up, just a virtual screening of it. And that's, you know, we're going to open that up to anyone. And so we just want to get eyes on it. But for me, what I want the nonprofit to do is to create content that then the people who want us to create that content can use for themselves. So I hope that Tamika, who started the whole project really, is able to take that little film and help promote her cause, which is to bring more awareness to that city. So that's what I'm hoping happens. Yeah.
I was curious to know what else. I assume you haven't put it forward in any film festivals here in Texas.
Not yet. I was too late for South By, and I want to be good enough for South By Southwest at some point. And so maybe a little bit of that too is just intimidation. But yes, I think I want to hear back from these two. I'm learning all about the film festival industry and how it works. And if it plays at one place, it can't play in another. So if it doesn't make either of these, then, you know, we'll see. And we may just do online screenings with it.
Sure. Well, if we could pivot a little bit here, you know, we started off talking about the pandemic. And I'm trying to remember. I think it was June of 2020 when we last spoke, if I'm not mistaken. It was sort of right at the beginning of the protests in the summer of 2020. It just seems like worlds away at this point, you know? Was that when you were leaving for Atlanta? Have I got the dates right there?
I was here in Atlanta, so I had just gotten here. I hadn't been here. I moved here December of 2019. So right before that really insane summer. But yes, it's been about that long. I think we did talk after that happened. Yeah, you're right. Ugh. It seemed like so long ago, and yet it seemed like it also, we're still feeling the reverberation of that summer that really rocked the world.
Exactly. You know, I think this is going to be comparable to much of what we experienced back in the 60s, you know. I mean, not just the BLM protests, but here in Austin, for example, the police response to all that. I don't know how much you're following Austin politics anymore, Austin events, but right now there's talk of a grand jury indicting as many as 18 Austin police officers for their conduct during the protests.
Yes, I've been following it. You know, it's why when anyone asks, Charlotte, where are you from? And I say, Austin, Texas. And they say, oh, that's just such a great place to be. And I say, yeah, you know, it's got nice trails and, you know, the weather's good. And, you know, there's always that but. And right. Then we begin to talk about, you know, even though it's quote unquote liberal, Austin's got some issues. So yes, I have been following that and I'm not surprised.
At the same time, you know, we've got a new DA and he has been indicting police officers. There is one police officer that has been indicted twice on first degree murder charges. That is Christopher Taylor, for both the shooting of Michael Ramos and Maurice De Silva. We've covered that plenty on the show here, but I'm not sure it's sunk in with a lot of people that nothing like this has ever happened before here in Austin.
Yeah, it's disheartening. And at the same time, it is interesting to read about those kinds of developments, that change is possible and it's happening.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Just a reminder, Co-op's spring membership drive is coming up soon. Avoid the rush and go to koop.org now. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on February 11th. Our guest is Charlotte Moore, filmmaker and writer originally from Austin, now living in Atlanta. Let's pick up where we left off.
And I want to make sure people know, like, I think that communities need watchdogs, you know, but I'm not even going to explain myself. It's not about being anti-police. This isn't a, for me anyway, it's not a blanket criticism of all police. There right. are many, many police people who every day do amazing work. But when a police officer does wrong, then history says many of them get a pass. And we know that systemically, the police state, the police system has just really been damaging and dangerous for people of color. So this is reality and you deal with it. When an officer does something they shouldn't do, when they kill someone, when they shoot people in the face with rubber bullets or whatever, that's not right. That's against the law. So you handle it. So it's good to see that happening.
I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about Atlanta in comparison to Austin, seeing as obviously the population differentials between the two cities are much different. So,
yes. Oh my God. You know, it was a culture shock when I moved here. back in 2001, right after 9/11, I moved here, and I was here for a couple of years, and I was a lot younger, and it was a culture shock because no matter where I go in this city, literally no matter where I go, there will be Black people. Mm. And for someone who grew up in Austin, Texas, and then Denver, Colorado, I noticed it every time. So it's a different place. Now, the whole time I've been here, we have been under, with COVID, I've been working from home. So I haven't really been able to get out and see the city the way I want. And I have to say this too, I am still probably more connected to what goes on in Austin, in Texas politics, more so than I am here at this point. So there's not a whole lot I can speak to, but I will say, even from the Black people here that I have met and talked with, the complaints are pretty much the same with the police officers. We just saw what happened with Ahmaud Arbery, and those weren't police, but I'm saying no matter where you go in this country, you're likely going to deal with issues of race and racism. Because as a country, we have to find a way to bring about some equity and equality and to change the minds of white people with regard to people of color. You know what I'm saying?
And at the same time, so we've been through an incredible social reckoning, I would say, especially in 2020. And yet now we find ourselves in what I would call a period of white backlash, especially here in the state of Texas. The legislature, which has never been very friendly to Austin, this past session seemed to be totally out of control, you know, between the teaching of critical race theory and punishing municipalities that reduce police budgets and voting rights. And I hardly know where to begin with all this stuff. What's your general feeling about this backlash that we seem to be experiencing right now?
Yeah, you know, my message, I talk to my brothers a lot, my daughter, and again, this is just my opinion, but I say buckle up because I think it's going to get much worse before there's any sort of leveling off or any sort of sanity takes over. Yeah, it is, what word to use? It is, again, not surprising, but it is shocking what governments around the country have done, and in Texas. I mean, Texas has been red for a long time, and a lot of people have been left behind because of that. And now, you know, I do believe that the summer of 2020, that was a phenomenal transition. That summer and what we saw, what we felt was just phenomenal. It was different. We all knew that this marked a turning point. And so it is not surprising to me that politically, the people who feel they have the most to lose from this shift are doing everything they can to hang on to power. And a lot of them bring up cancel culture, but it's clear to me anyway that they're doing everything they can to cancel voices. Again, we shouldn't be shocked because that is the American way. It's what America has done from its inception, mm-hmm. is to just completely nullify and discount whole groups of people. But you're right. What's happening in Texas is, again, it's not terribly surprising, but it's really amazing to watch it happen.
Last week, we had Chaz Moore on the show, and I presented him with the same notion there, the same prospect of white backlash. And Chris Harris was on too. Chris called it white lash.
You know? But, yes, yes.
Chaz Moore's take on it was interesting. He said, you know, it's always been this way. And in some ways in the past, it's been a lot worse. And we're going to deal with it. You know, this is our reality today, and this is our challenge, you know. And I must say I was somewhat heartened by that because I got to tell you, this stuff is really getting me down.
Yeah, I know it is, Bob, because I know you, and it should. It should get all of us down.
Yeah.
But the sad thing to me is that, you know, I'm familiar with Chaz Moore and his work. The sad thing for me is that there are many Black people who are so accustomed to this kind of retribution, unjustified. Mm-hmm. They're so used to it that they say, we're going to be okay. We're going to get past this. When will we reach a point where Black people are not having to deal with this and get past it? Do you know what that does? What that does to a person's body to constantly be under that kind of tension and stress? You just spoke about it with John McCown and the kind of intense scrutiny that comes when you are Black and you are constantly having to push back against unjustified actions, actions that are actually designed to keep you down. I agree with him. We're not going back. So I don't care how many hats people put on that suggest it. I don't care. We are never going to go back to where we've been. More and more people are aware now. We know what's happening. We know what the designs are. And so once you know, the more you know, the more empowered you are to protect yourself. So
I'd say that, yeah, your particular films that you've put out there are part of the drops in the bucket that hopefully will create the flood of information out there and to bring the awareness that's needed, because I think that's a big part of it. And the more people who bring attention to it in their own ways, you through your films, others through writing, that cascade is something that's been significant to me of late. Just this sheer amount of information that's getting out there. For those of us who pay attention, that is, it's unprecedented in itself because it hasn't been there before. It's been a trickle, but technology today has certainly changed the sphere of awareness for everybody, I think, is what I'm getting at. Right now, we're having some backlash there too, obviously. Misinformation and disinformation and fake news and all those different aspects of it. But the more that people like you and your colleagues out there that are putting forth the factual information for us to consume, I think the better things hopefully can get. It's just a matter of time. And hopefully we can all hang on till that time comes.
I love that. I love that. And I'm right there with you. I appreciate what you're saying. And I am learning just like you. And I'm grateful for people like you and Bob and Jim and others who get it, who are not offended, or you don't appear to be frightened by history and what it means. I think, you know, what I get from you all is that you are confident enough in who you are to accept the truth and then to, you know, act accordingly. But we're all learning. We are all learning as we go. And so I appreciate you all.
Thanks for that. That means a lot coming from you, Charlotte. You know, one other thought I had about all this and just thinking about all this ugly stuff that's going on right now, not to pour sugar over everything, but maybe, you know, just maybe the strength of the backlash is a testament to the depth of the changes that people have experienced. You know, maybe they're just feeling that much more moved by what they've seen and frightened to the point where they know no other way but to send out bomb threats against historically Black institutions, for example.
Yeah, I can see that. And you're right. It is a convoluted way to look at it, but that's because things are pretty convoluted. Yeah. And yes, I can see that. It's the pressure. The pressure is on, and it's been on for decades and decades. And so, yeah, you might be right that that's just a sign that the needle is moving. And so we shall see.
One little side story here. I may have told this before on the show here. With these book bans, you know, this all really kind of hit the fan a few months ago here. seems to be taking off throughout a lot of the country, unfortunately. At the high school, I happened to be in the library and I was joking around with the librarian. She had one book on the counter there and I said, that wouldn't happen to be one of those banned books, would it? And she pointed to a corner of the library where she had built a display of banned books.
Wow.
And put big arrows on them and signs indicating that the state of Texas does not want you to read this book.
Wow.
I got to say that at least there's some really good spirit there in some of the schools, at least the one that I've been familiar with.
We better wake up. You know, we think history, there are whole sayings about history repeating itself. History repeats until you stop it, until you wake up and grow up and stop the nonsense. So yeah, what's happening with these banned books is disgusting and it's shameful. And, you know, this is hitting all sorts of communities, you know, communities of color, Black communities, Black books, books about gender. I mean, I just want to say we got to wake up. Do we see what's happening here? And this grotesque desire to erase history. And I get it. Again, it is a fear factor. It's motivated by fear and the fear of people losing their power and losing their superiority and losing control. When you begin to threaten someone's control, they will come for you. That's going to end us all. It is disgusting. It's Toni Morrison. I mean, yes. There's so much richness. These are stories that so many Black people can relate to. Can I tell one quick thing that's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And this is aside from the banned books, but Halle Berry just did a film called Bruised. Mm-hmm. And so did...
Maggie Gyllenhaal.
Thank you.
Maggie Gyllenhaal, yeah.
So I watched both those films. I watched Bruised first, and I cried twice. And I cried because I could so relate to that story. I could so relate to the relationships within that story. I watched The Lost Daughter and I could relate to that too. That was a great film too. Bruised is a great film, but because I believe the people who make the decisions about what's good and what's not are not Black, so much of the nuance from Halle Berry's film just I don't even think it rated. I mean, she got no love for her film. That is a story that, again, I can really relate to. It makes so much sense to me. Same thing with these books, many of them. They make so much sense to marginalized groups. And the people who are saying those books can't be read are the ones who wouldn't get it anyway, who wouldn't, you know, and they're not even willing to try to understand. And it's not about affirmative action. It's not about saying Halle Berry's film is good, you know, just because. It's about realizing that your perspective is not the only perspective. It's the one that has the most power. It's the one that's had the most power traditionally. But there are many other stories in this country that need to be told. Taking the book off the shelf does not erase the history or the story. And so it is disgusting what is happening.
You know, there was a time when Banned in Boston was a good way to sell books, you know. And, you know, just maybe that will be the outcome of all of this.
That's right.
If they don't totally eradicate every copy out there, which would be 9 possible, it may well be that this will spark its own renaissance, but time will tell.
Gonna let it be erased.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I was gonna say quickly, I'm looking at a picture right now of a shelf like that with banned books. And I mean, the books that I'm looking at, some of them I've read, like books that have changed, books that I didn't want to end that ended, you know, it is just shameful.
Well, thoughts going forward, either your own personal plans or the arc of history? I mean, what do you think about when you ponder the future?
It might be a little bit of COVID and just the same sort of ennui and exhaustion that a lot of people are feeling, but I've been mentally and emotionally exhausted just with everything that's happening, from the stuff happening in America. But it's not just America. The police commissioner in the UK just resigned after scandals. A report came out that said the police department in London dealing with racism, misogyny. So, but like Chaz said, you have to keep going. I want to keep doing films. I want to keep focusing on the Black story because it matters as much as any other story. And I'll be in Austin next week, and I will be looking for other stories to tell out of the Austin area. So I'm a little excited and I'm a little exhausted.
Well, totally understandable. I remember when the U.S. invaded Iraq back in 2003, I went into a pretty serious depression. And I called up a friend of mine and I said, you know, I'm really depressed. And he said, well, you should be. It's depressing.
Right. Yes. Yes. It would be weird if you weren't.
There you go. So, yeah, there's the reality that we're in. But I think perspective has got to be our friend in all this, and hope and optimism. Certainly appreciate all the work you've done. It was nice to watch that little film, The Spirit of Sparta. I hope that you take that many places, and that ultimately I hope that it brings good things for all those people in that town.
Well, thank you. I hope so too. And I can't thank you all enough for all of your support and encouragement. That means everything. And I welcome your criticism, because that will help me grow. As a filmmaker, I want to grow. So I appreciate you all.
Well, thanks for joining us, Charlotte. It was great to hear from you. And now I look forward to the next project that you put out there. So I concur with Bob's sentiments as well. I do hope that this film helps the town of Sparta, and much more than that. It just adds to the awareness, like I said, of all of us and what's going on around us.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much. It's always an honor to speak with you, and I hope we do so again soon.
I would love that. I'm always here. I love talking and listening to you all, so I would love it.
It's Friday afternoon, February 11th, and once again we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing today, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Always a pleasure. It looked like a head roll this morning in the city. Who could see that coming, huh?
Right. Yeah. Greg Massaros, 15-year director of Austin Water, submitted his resignation to city manager Spencer Kronk. He's still on the job. It's not clear exactly when he's resigning, but of course, this follows the conclusion of the boil water notice earlier this week, the third one in 4 years, you know, which is, you know, unusual for a city of Austin's size, right? We would kind of expect our infrastructure to be better taken care of. You know, that being said, one of those boil water notices was during the 2021 freeze, kind of an act of God, right? So pretty difficult to control that. But what little we know about this most recent one suggests, according to Austin Water's kind of early observations, is that this may have been a human error. Some staff issues may have kind of caused this precautionary boil water notice. And we've kind of learned since it was first initiated last weekend, it was mostly precautionary, right? That there was not really any issue that took very long to remedy for the staff. But obviously, when you're talking about a million customers here using Austin Water and could potentially get very sick from drinking tainted water. So there is a great deal of need to be precautious. And so they had to, you know, again, issue that advisory until Tuesday night is when it expired.
Yeah, when I heard that it really was strictly precautionary and that there was probably no need to actually boil the water, I commented to a friend that
I almost wish they hadn't told me that, you know?
Yeah, right. It is frustrating. I had a couple of times where I like brushed my teeth with tap water completely absentmindedly. So I was like, okay. And afterward, in the moment, I was like, oh, great. I'm going to get stomach issues or whatever. But thankfully, it wasn't anything. So Mazaros announced his resignation, and there's still more movement happening on this story. Council member Allison Alter is kind of calling for an external audit of Austin's water infrastructure, of course, motivated by the three boil water advisories over the past 4 years. And council member Paige Ellis has really led the charge on holding a kind of special city council meeting to discuss this issue. And that's been scheduled for Tuesday at 9 a.m. earlier today. So we'll see what kind of resulted from that meeting. But yeah, this is really gaining the attention of our elected officials, right? It's just something, again, that a city of our size, growing as much as we are, it is concerning, you know, to have these kinds of advisories issued 3 times in 4 years, maybe infrequent, but certainly too frequent, again, for a city of our size and experience our level of growth.
I know that Allison Alter actually chairs the audit committee for the city council, so I suppose this is most appropriate coming from her.
You're right about that. Also, there is a water utility oversight committee that Councilmember Leslie Poole, who is on that committee, has said will show up on an agenda in one of their upcoming meetings. So yeah, this is definitely going to get looked at, this issue, from all kinds of angles.
The water utility has been, if not controversial, certainly the focus of a lot of attention, given the great interest in environment in the city, you know, going back to at least Save Our Springs.
Oh, yeah, right. And kind of having public utilities in Austin Energy and Austin Water is seen as like a really big benefit for most of our residents. And certainly we'll see how this oversight process, investigative and accountability project proceeds from here, but it should give the people of Austin, through their elected leaders, more power and oversight of these two utilities compared to if they were just privately owned.
Well, I suppose there's some politics in all this, but at the very least, I suppose some officials high up the line who will remain nameless are probably happy that their own heads are not on a platter in this thing, right?
Right. Yeah. I've had a few people kind of observe to me that it seems there have been recently department heads getting in trouble at the city, but the top department head, the city manager, continues to kind of skate by. So we'll see how long council can kind of let that keep going before they turn their attention to the chief executive of the city government.
And I'm not interested in launching speculation here or anything, but it is interesting to just see how the political fallout occurs in this.
Right, I agree.
So in other council news, I did see that Chito Vela was sworn in, and the third would have been Greg Kassar's final meeting.
Yeah, that's right. February 3rd was Councilmember Kassar's final meeting. He was not physically in the city hall, the council chambers. Only Mayor Adler was there because that was the first day of the ice storm. The city staff were all kind of staying home and council members were attending virtually. So it was kind of interesting, I guess kind of fitting, given that most of the meetings over the past 2 years because of the pandemic were conducted virtually. So yeah, he got to say his goodbyes, pass two resolutions, directing staff to kind of draft these kind of renter bill of rights aimed at shoring up tenant protections through the city, codifying some of these eviction protections that manifested through the pandemic. And then, yeah, Chito Vela, the new council member for District 4, he was sworn in, and his first meeting will be later this week, February 17th.
And in the meantime, I'm sure Greg's focus is on the primaries, which when we air, early voting will have already commenced.
That's right. Valentine's Day, February 14th, Monday, was the first day of early voting. And 2 days before that, Saturday and Sunday, Kassar teamed up with Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York, obviously. She came down to Texas to rally for him on Saturday in San Antonio and Sunday here in Austin. So that'll likely be a big boost for his get out the vote efforts.
And the Chronicle has issued its endorsements, so our listeners can read all about that in your paper.
That's right. Yeah, they're online and they'll be in every issue leading up to March 1st, Election Day.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure to have you here, and may the good weather continue. It's a beautiful Friday afternoon here as we record this.
Sure is, yeah.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again, Bob. I appreciate it.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone. Stay tuned for Co-op's Local Music Mix next on KOOP.org. And a reminder that Co-op's Spring Membership Drive is coming up soon. Avoid the rush and go to coop.org now.